morning. So, if you have been here recently, you know that we've been going through a series called Countercultural. And if you're new and you're just showing up here for this morning, we're thankful that you're here. But in this series, Countercultural, we're talking about what it means to live in a world that is based solely upon the Bible and the principles that we learn in it. What do we learn about how God has asked us to live among the world? What does he mean about all of that? So this morning, we are going to talk a little bit about a character we haven't talked about a lot. He's interesting, but he scares a lot of people. Around the world, people fear his name. They fear what he looks like. Perhaps in your mind, you see him with horns and a pointy tail and a snake, tongue. He's a very interesting character and a sobering reminder of what it means who our enemy is and our adversary. This morning, we're going to be talking about Satan. We're going to be talking about a biblical stance on who Satan is and what we should fear about him. If you want to turn to Genesis chapter 3. So at the beginning of our series, we usually started in Genesis 1 or 2, because we see there the ideal of what God has wanted, what God wanted for his creation originally, what was deemed to be fit from the beginning. But when we talk about the great adversary that man has ever faced, there is no good place to start. There's only the fall. Genesis chapter 3, starting in verse 1. It says, "Now the serpent was more crafty than any other beast of the field that the Lord God had made. He said to the woman, 'Did God actually say, you shall not eat of any tree in the garden?' And the woman said to the serpent, 'You may eat of the fruit of the trees in the garden. But God said, you may not eat of the fruit of the tree that is in the midst of the garden. Now neither shall you touch it, lest you die.' The serpent said to the woman, 'You will not surely die. For God knows that if you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil.' So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, that it was a delight to the eyes, that the tree was a desire to make one wise, she took its fruit and she ate. And she also gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate. Then the eyes of both were opened, and they knew that they were naked, and sewed fig leaves together and made for themselves loincloths." So in the beginning of the story, we see the same thing for who he is. We see him as a character who is wise and kind. While we don't see Satan's name particularly in this story, we do see his characters. Later in the Bible, they call him the father of lies. And you see that that's the heart of his personality. That he knows what the command is. And he gets Eve to say it after him. What is it? What did God say? But he places that seed of doubt in her mind. Did God actually mean that? Is God being honest with? Is he being truthful with me? Is there some other knowledge of something that I don't understand that he hasn't given me? And that's what he has. But you also realize in the story that Satan is very limited in what he can do. That he leads Eve into a distraction. And he says, "Oh, did God actually say this?" But he can't force the food into her mouth. He can't make her eat of it. All he can say is play on her desire that she has for this fruit. The desire she has to be her own God. She made that hers. So what it says in this verse is that she takes, after she sees and she desires it, then she takes it for herself individually. Satan is only limited by telling us what we do. He leads us astray. He tells us that we can be our own God as he does in our life. That you can be who you want. You can do whatever you want. Right? You have that ability. You can choose that life for yourself. Which is all things he says is abominable. So we see in the story how this, while we don't know this again, that this snake, there's plenty of things you can speculate about in the story. But we see that in the curse, that something is coming that's going to end this serpent's rule. That's going to end Satan's rule. Down in verse 14, it says, "The Lord God said to the serpent, 'Because you have done this, Cursed are you above all livestock and above all beasts of the field. On your belly you shall dwell, and dust you shall eat all the days of your life. I will put enmity between you and the woman, between your offspring and her offspring. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel. That for all time, until man ends, you are going to be at war with him. And then someone, he will bruise, or in our translations, crush your head. You will bruise his heel. And in some ways, you will have a small victory over him, but it will not be eternal. His victory over you will be eternal.
So we get an interesting glimpse into the Satan from the very first start of the Bible. But what exactly does Satan mean? Like, let's look at that. If you think about it, over and over again, the Hebrew text, you don't see Satan's name very much. We'll see him, we're going to talk in Job a little bit. We see him a little bit there, but outside of that, it's used about 23 times in the Old Testament, the Hebrew word for Satan. And an interesting thing that I learned pretty recently is that there's actually usually an article in front of Satan. So it's not like Satan, a name that we would put on it. It's actually the Satan, or a Satan, which means the adversary, the enemy. And I find it a little bit weird about that, that God wrote this book, and it's a story about him and his love and his redemptive nature. And his enemy, he put him in there not as a name threat, but as the enemy. That's it. Now, it's not to make us underestimate his power, because he has a lot. But it's understanding that God has more power, that in his story, he's just an antagonist. But we're going to look into a little bit more of Satan's nature if you turn over to Job 1. Job 1, starting in verse 1. It says, "Now there was a man of the land, in the land of Uz whose name was Job. And that man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. There were born in him 7 sons and 3 daughters. He possessed 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 female donkeys, and the very many servants of him, so that this man was the greatest of all people of the east. His sons used to go and hold a feast in the house of each of one of his dead. And he would send and invite the 3 sisters to eat and drink. When the days of peace had run their course, Job would send to consecrate, and he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of the law. For Job said, "It may be that my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." Thus Job did continually. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came on. The Lord said to Satan, "From where have you come?" And Satan answered the Lord and said, "From going to and fro on the earth, and walking up and down." And the Lord says to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from you?" Then Satan answered the Lord and said, "Does Job fear God for no reason? Have you not put a hedge around him and around his house and all everything he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, his possessions have increased in the land. But stretch out your hand and touch all he has, and he will curse you to your face." And the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, all that he has in your hand, only against him do not stretch your hand." So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. So we read in Job,
in the beginning, we see this character, King Job. He's a super great guy. He's got a lot of wealth. We don't necessarily measure our wealth in the same way now, but he's got a lot of sheep and camels. He's got 2 kids, and that's a blessing from the Lord, having many children. But the top 3 things about Job is that the fact that he was blameless, that he was righteous inside God, and that he represented and he created. Those are the top 3 things about Job. It didn't matter about all this other stuff. So we see at the beginning how Job is like sacrificing for his kids. He's just a really kind, awesome guy. A guy you like that. And that's what makes the rest of Job, the next 42 chapters, most of them, just aren't. But, we see this interesting thing that happens in the beginning.
So he asks, where are you? Says, like, oh, I've been everywhere. And he's doing my thing. So God asks him, well, have you heard about this guy? Jacob's famous person. Almost poking fun at him, knowing that Satan is limited. While God knows it all. And that frustration immediately builds. I think so often we kind of read this and it's just like, you know, it's kind of flustered a little bit that he got called out. But this is anger. This is maddening. That there was someone out here that God was saying, oh, he's blameless, he's righteous. He has money. You take that away from him, he's going to curse you. He has family. You take that away from him, he's going to curse you to your face. He's going to tell you that they're not worthy. What we see in this story right here at the beginning is that Satan is angry. He's frustrated. He's vengeful. He's angry. This is a good person, a good God. And his reaction to a blessed man is evil. It's vengeance to say that I will take this away from you. Satan is a character who is the epitome of what is wrong in the world. But the crazy thing is that some people lot. I was kind of having a conversation with this last week with some people, and I figured it would play really well into my sermon this morning. So I did some research into the Church of Satan and wondered why anyone would worship Satan. Not the church, right? So their explanation, this is on their homepage, says that he represents pride, liberty, and individualism, qualities often defined as evil by those who worship external deities who feel that there is a war between their minds and emotions. Now basically what Satan does, because he just lets us do whatever he wants, he sets us free. Little do they know they're still in bondage to sin. That hasn't happened. That Satan hasn't made them free. Satan has put them in different chains. And the even more ironic part for me is down here. We Satanists are thus our own gods, and as beneficent deities, we can offer love to those who deserve it and deliver our wrath within reasonable limits upon those who seek to cause us or that which we cherish harm. The idea that I am, where did we just see that? But in the Bible. Where Satan told the lie that you can be your own. My question to people who worship Satan, who worship this deity, how well has man been his own God? You tell me how well that's gone. My hometown, I love it to death. I love it to death. This is the sex trafficking capital of the United States. Not even the world, and it's terrible. And what do they do with these sexually trafficked people? Abuse them on porn sites. So people watch people being abused on their computers. We have people who claim that religion caused all the wars. The reality is most of the wars are caused by greed and power. The fact that my army is better than your army, therefore I'm going to take you, I'm going to destroy you, I want what you have. That, as we talked about last week, some people on this planet hate others simply because of the way they look and because of the fact that they talk, because they're from a different place, because they have a different culture. That's how man has become his own God. That's how he treats other people when he's his own God. You can't tell me that that's not Satan lying to us. And that's Satan telling us that we can be whatever we want to be, and that's okay. We're supposed to be like God. God is unsurpassable. He's incredible. He's omnipotent. All we can hope to be is his servants. That should be our aim, our goal. We have some glory that comes out of that because he loves himself to be exalted by that. We have a reminder of one man who did not fall for this trick over and over. If you want to look at Matthew chapter 4. Bread. He answered, it is written, man shall not live by bread alone, shall not put the Lord your God to test. And again, the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kings of the world and their glory. And he said to him, all these I will give to you if you fall down and worship me. Then Jesus said to him, be gone, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve. Then the devil left him, and behold, the angels came and were ministering to him.
So,
in the Greek language, the devil takes, or Satan takes on a new persona, which is the devil. It's the same. So it's a different word, but it's just not the same thing. And here, we see Jesus, the God-man, who was driven out to the wilderness, see if he's going to fall like every other man. It's a test to see you are going to be going through some terrible punishment, that you're going to be tempted with a lot of things. Will you actually be able to? In this invitation, we see Jesus pass with flying colors. That as he's out in the wilderness, starving for no doubt, for 40 days without food or word of promise. But he's out there by himself. It's like if it's some God, like, you know, this is pretty neat, right? Making it yourself. But it's a reminder, he gives him a reminder that is given in Deuteronomy. All he just wants is from Deuteronomy. That, hey, God told me that I can lie. That bread can fill my stomach for a little while, but God fills my soul for eternity. And I'm not going to ask my God to bear me up and do foolish things to act and seek to have peace, to love me, or if he cares for me. I know he loves and cares for me. I believe that. I don't need to prove that to you or to myself. And you can't give me all kings of the world. You can't give me all the glory because I know all the glory belongs to my God. That's it. These are the same temptations that were posed to Israel. These are the same temptations that were posed to every man. You want to be your own God. You want to do things. You want to act like you've got it all there. And Jesus admits that he is just a man, and glory belongs to God. A total reversal of the problems that man has had since the very beginning. And it shows that with God's help and with his word, he can resist the devil. He's a strong enemy. He attacks us when we're weak. And he waited until 40 days and he knew that he was at his hunger. So he's like, I'm going to teach you. That I know that you don't want to die. You know that's what you're going to have to do. You don't have to do it. You can escape. Or do you actually believe that God cared for you? Does he drag you out here to deal with me? Does he actually care for you? Jesus didn't doubt. He didn't doubt not his own power, but the power of the God. And that's the same that we should be emulating. So, we see that in Jesus' life as we go through, he is without sin. The mission of God. And I kind of wish we had a picture of what Satan looked like at this moment. He's not. There's no doubt in my mind that he didn't know like, what was going to happen. He's, again, yeah, very limited. He's not meant to talk to God. So, seeing Jesus die, I did it. I killed the only God who was able to resist me. And 3 days later, he's beaten. It was no reason. Our confidence isn't in the fact that we can beat Satan on our own, because we can't. But our confidence is that our man, our sacrifice, our King of Kings, if you want to turn to Revelation chapter 20, this is the end of Satan. This is how he's going to be remembered. Revelation was written to a people who is being persecuted heavily by Rome. There are people who, under Roman regimes, have told, they said that we are God and God's God. And because of this, the Christians are being persecuted. They're being thrown in lion dens, they're being crucified, they are outcasts of society, they are hated people. But John and God is showing that Satan's going to lose. Revelation is full of allegory and messages and all these weird things. But it's pretty clear to see that the message is God. Revelation chapter 20, starting in verse 1. Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, holding in his hand the key to the bottomless pit, and a great chain, and seized the dragon, that ancient serpent, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years, and threw him in the pit, and shut it, and sealed it open, that he might not deceive the nations any longer, until 1,000 years reign. After that, he was released for a little while. And I saw thrones and seated on them, and those whom the authority to judge was committed. Also, I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded for the testimony of Jesus, and for the word of God, and those who had not worshipped the beast or its image, and had not received its mark on their foreheads or on their hands. And they came to life, and they reigned with Christ for 1,000 years, and the rest of the dead did not come to life until 1,000 years from now. This is the first resurrection. Blessed and holy is the one who shares the first resurrection. Over such, the second death has no power, and they will be priests of God and of Christ. And they will reign with him for 1,000 years. And when 1,000 years are ended, Satan will be released from prison, and he will come out to deceive the nations that are at the four corners of the earth, God and God, and to gather them back. Their number is like the sand of the sea, and marched up over the broad plain of the earth, and surrounded the camp of the saints in the blooded city. The fire came down from heaven and consumed them. And the devil, who had deceived them, was thrown into the lake of fire, and so forth were the beast and the false prophet. And they will be tormented day and night forever.
The thing that separates the saints and those who listen to the devil are the ones who listen to the words of God. Again, what we're supposed to be doing in counterculture is listening to the words that we're given by God and seeing how we live our lives based upon it. So Satan's goal is to, oh, those are the words of God, let me twist them so they fit your own heart, so that you can essentially decide who you're going to be for yourself, all right? Well, we see the end of the devil. Again, this is like his third trial of trying to overcome God. And he goes out, he gathers people from all corners of the earth. He deceives them all. He says, let's go attack these saints. They have a small number. So they rise up to battle. All of them come together. And it's like, it's a dragon. And it's a giant army that is like the sand of the sea. It's a dramatic event. And in one verse, God shows up. All this world, all this power that Satan is supposed to have in the face of God, he can do absolutely nothing. That ultimately, the love of God, the sacrifice that he shows, is far greater than the hateful visions that we might have. And then he is thrown in the pit, and he doesn't see it anywhere. Nobody can walk. He's stuck in the pit forever. Our confidence doesn't come from ourselves. We know that Satan is a powerful adversary. We know that he comes at us with vulnerable weakness. The reality is that Satan's also limited when he's compared to our God. So as we go through this life, we shouldn't be walking on eggshells like he's going to get us every moment. Because in honesty, that's fearing Satan more than we fear God. The command is that we fear God. Because when we know that he's with us, we know how, we know his greatness. So we have nothing to fear. Let us fear him and him alone.
Will you pray for me?